The indie farming hit Stardew Valley, where stylish pixel graphics will hook you as you build your perfect farm, is just one of the excellent titles available to play now on Apple Arcade. Enjoy unlimited access to over 200 incredibly fun games with no ads and no in-app purchases. From puzzle and adventure games to sports, racing, and multiplayer action games, everyone can count on finding something to love. Head to sifter.com.au/arcade to start your free trial of Apple Arcade today. That's sifter.com.au/arcade for a free 1 month trial of Apple Arcade, and you'll be supporting independent video games journalism. This offer is for new subscribers only, $9.99 a month after free trial. Plan automatically renews after trial until cancelled.
It lets me live out my fantasy of being tiny and a little guy.
It brings a lot of life, I think, to the entire experience from the game.
Horror movies, TV shows, absolutely no way. But spooky co-op games, for some reason I love.
Can you fight Mike Tyson?
Streamlines the mechanics without dumbing them down.
All you can do is jump and that's it, and you're off.
Plenty of anime waifus in it, and it's a relatively horny game.
Sifter.com.au.
G'day, I'm Chris Button, and this is Drop Rate, Sifter's video game review podcast. It's Game of the Year time once again, so join me with the entire Sifter crew as we look back at the best games of 2024.
Join the Sifter community on Discord at sifter.com.au/Discord.
Hi, I'm Kyle Paletto.
And I'm Fiona Bartholomaeus.
And here are the top stories this week on Walkthrough, Sifter's weekly news podcast for Sunday, 15th of December.
We recap the big winners and announcements from the Game Awards, including some massive new games.
Indie game marketplace Itch is taken offline after a false DMCA claim from Funko.
LEGO Fortnite goes after GTA Online and Counter-Strike players with two brand new modes.
And Casemaker D-Brand just straight up shows off the Switch 2. Like, seriously.
You can get every episode of Walkthrough for free on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or on our website, sifter.com.au, every Sunday.
Adam, your Game of the Year is one I'm very excited to hear about. Partly because I don't actually know how to pronounce the title of which, but I've also heard incredible things about. Adam, could you please introduce us to your Game of the Year and why it's your pick?
Yeah, look, I'm going to pronounce it as 1,000 times resist, and it is an indie game that I have been wanting to play for most of this year and finally got around to in the last couple of weeks. It's made by a team called Sunset Traveler that are based in Canada. And it is just a fascinating narrative game. It's definitely one of those games that's very light on mechanics, and it's really like walking simulator is something that you could coin it under. Visual novel is something else that you could sort of kind of mesh it in with. But I think you could also compare this game a lot to experiential theater. And sort of like theater practice in a lot of ways, which makes a lot of sense considering the development team originally were an artist group that worked together on collaborative theater and sound pieces pre-pandemic and then got together during lockdowns and started working on a video game. It is a science fiction romp. I think actually romp is a weird word because it's very meditative. It's set about 30 years in the future, or maybe it's 1,000 years in the future. It's hard to say. You play a character called Watcher who lives in a society of clones in a weird world under the ground. There has been some sort of virus that's taken out all of human society. And Watcher lives with their various clone siblings in the underground and worships a being called the All Mother. And you sort of play Watcher's story as they explore the All Mother's memories of when they were a teenage girl before the pandemic hit, what happened to them, their connection to why the future is now all clones of that person, and a whole bunch of other stuff happens. It's also loosely tied into the 2019 Hong Kong resistance riots and has a lot of threads to connect there as well around the idea of diaspora and trauma and the longing for cities and places that are now gone for you. It's just a really phenomenal game with some fantastic writing that reminds me of Wong Kar Wai films and also Battlestar Galactica from 2003. So that's like my mood point for the game, really.
Sounds like it pulls on real pandemic stuff. Is that kind of threaded through all of this, Adam?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, Sunset Visitor, the development team working behind this, have talked a bit about that, you know, because the game was made originally in COVID, it pulls on themes of pandemic and viruses and isolation, but it sort of goes far more broader than that with what it's doing. And really, it's a conversation about like what it's like to be diaspora and move cities and countries, what it's like to miss the city that you came from, what it's like to struggle with the cultural identity that you have if you're born from parents who are from the diaspora, or you're trying to enmesh yourself into a new culture. And then all of that is happening in the backdrop of a very gnarly science fiction plot, which is really fascinating as well. It's sort of pulling on the idea of nature versus nurture and clones and identity. It's wild.
One thing I'd love to hear a little bit more about, Adam, in terms of the gameplay or sort of the core loop of this, because as you say, it's sort of visual novel, sort of walking sim, and everyone that I've heard from who's played this game has said, you must play this. But I'm still actually none the wiser as to sort of the actual structure of the game. So I'm very curious about the mechanics of it, if that's something you can explain.
Yeah, structurally, the game sort of takes place mostly in an area called the Orchard, which is like essentially a home base where all the clones live. Watcher has a floating robot with them called Secretary, which allows it to form communions with people, which is sort of like going into their subconscious and being able to visit memories. And that's sort of how you visit the memories of the All Mother, who is sort of the god, but also the girl that all these clones have come from, that existed all the way back in the 2040s before the alien invasion and virus that kicked everything off happened. And so while you're exploring the All Mother's memories, you can sort of use this mechanic that allows you to flip through time in the same space that you're in. So maybe you jump forward a year or two in the same space and watch some scenes in one timeline and then bounce back a few years and watch another. So say you're in an apartment, you can sort of bounce between multiple years in that apartment and see different conversations and stories between characters in it sort of happen and take place in it. And then I would say the first half of the game is really about Watcher having communions with her various other sort of clone sisters that are all sort of leading the sort of culture and the world of this place. So there's a few, this is a society where people are put into sort of roles based on like positions that they should work towards. So Watcher's role is to watch and to see how people interact and to then report on people's behavior. It's sort of very odd and weird. But there is a character called Fixer who fixes things that break down. There's a character called Noah who studies libraries and knowledge. There's Healer who works in the medical facility. So you work with all these various characters and sort of commune with them and then explore different memories. And that sort of makes up the sort of chapter and episodic structure of the game. But it does this thing with camera angles and perspective swaps, which I think is really smart. And the developers have talked about how this was sort of inspired by the Nier Automata games, where, you know, at one moment you'll be in a third person over the shoulder camera view. In another scene, it might be first person. In another scene, the camera might zoom all the way out and be a top down view. In another shot from there, you might be in a side scroller for a while. So it's constantly changing perspective of the environments that you're exploring, which makes the movement through them sort of really interesting and fascinating and, to be honest, a bit joyful. Like, I think these sorts of games where you're really just walking from place to place and talking to people and making decisions can be considered quite dull or boring to explore. But the way that perspective shifts and camera changes happen all the time can really impact the mood of a scene and really change fundamental ways that you're approaching how you explore those spaces as well, which I really liked. Plus, every single line of dialogue in this game is voiced and performed by an acting group, and it brings a lot of life, I think, to the entire experience from the game.
For sure. And that certainly adds to the chorus of very strong voices, or voices of very strong recommendations I've heard about 1,000 times resist. So I'm very keen to check this one out. But I also know there's another game you've been playing very, very recently at the time of recording, which is one of your honourable mentions, that being the early access launch of Path of Exile 2. Adam, how has this captured your attention in such a short space of time?
Yeah, look, we, as of time of recording, we are like 29 hours or whatever into Path of Exile 2 having launched. And I played 18 hours and hurt my hand. There's something about this game. Like, I did not really enjoy the first Path of Exile. I was watching it as it was happening from beta and was keen to play it, but sort of never got around to it. And then by the time I tried to dip into it, it was a few kind of years into the game, and they'd layered mechanics upon mechanics upon mechanics into the game that made it very obtuse and sort of difficult to sort of approach. Path of Exile 2 is really exciting because it offers an opportunity to sort of be on the ground floor of a new game from a development company who are kind of creating some of the most exciting stuff in sort of the ARPG space. And I think what they're doing in this game is really exciting as well, because it plays nothing like any other ARPG I've played before. So while it has the feel and the tone of Path of Exile 1 and the atmosphere that people loved of the early Diablo games, the sort of gothic fantasy horror, the sort of power fantasy of leveling up and finding gear and all that stuff, what they have done is really honed in the difficulty to a massive degree and brought in WASD controls into Path of Exile, as well as controller controls, with the idea that you really want to be using WASD and no longer clicking on isometrically to sort of move around. And you have a dodge roll with iframes, and there's no other way to describe this. It's a bit like Dark Souls. It is really hard. It is really punishing. You really have to watch enemy attacks, even from the most simple enemies. Otherwise, you're going to lose like a quarter of your health, half your health. And, you know, I think a lot of people are either having an amazing time with it or are bouncing off it quite profoundly at the moment. So it seems to be quite polarizing. I'm really loving every element of it. I think the challenge, the skill, the difficulty of it is really satisfying and exciting. It clearly needs a bit of tweaks. But for an early access game, this is something really weird and special. And unlike any other action RPG I've ever played, in that I need full 100% focus while I'm playing it. It's not like put on a second screen, listen to a podcast, and go grinding for hours. This is like I miss a dodge or two on this boss and I'm probably dying.
So from what you're saying, it certainly sounds like the New Zealand team have put quite the foundation there for Path of Exile 2. So sounds like it's one to watch as that continues to develop throughout active development. So thank you so much for sharing those games, Adam.
You're listening to Drop Rate by Sifter. Visit us on sifter.com.au.
Our next game of the year mention comes from Courtney Smith, and it's also one of my favourite games of 2024 in Astrobot, the joyful 3D platformer from PlayStation. Courtney, I'd love to hear from you. Why is Astrobot your game of the year?
The best thing about Astrobot is that it lets me live out my fantasy of being tiny and a little guy. So besides that, though, first of all, Astrobot is just this neat little package of a game, which I adore. And strangely, as someone who loves live service games and games that I can play for hours and hours and hours, the thing I love about Astrobot is the fact that it wraps up nicely and it ends. And it feels exactly like the games from my childhood that I played on PlayStation 1 and PlayStation 2 that were just little, like, level-based collectathon games where you go around and you collect, you know, whether it's Wumpa fruit or gems or dragons. And for Astrobot, it's these little guys. You collect little Astrobot guys that are references to all of these old games and bring a sense of nostalgia. But even if you don't know them, like there were loads in there that I didn't know, I was still like, oh my God, that little robot has hair. Wow. And it was the best thing ever. So that's why Astrobot is my game of the year. I think if you're trying to get someone into gaming or you want to have a fun, you know, I guess like family experience even, I really highly recommend Astrobot.
It's a big ad though. It really feels like an ad in many, many ways. I agree with you. It's like really nice. It's super fun. It's like the best game that, but it should feels like it should come free with your PlayStation when you buy it. What do you reckon about that?
I kind of agree with the sentiment of it coming free with a PlayStation, like being the game that comes with it. You know, I guess when we think about games like Wii Sports or Wii Play, those games as like a kind of add-on, like, you know, you pay an extra, what was it, like $20 and you get those games. I think it definitely should be in that same vein of, you know, coming with the PlayStation as a bit of a bundle even. In terms of it being an ad, I kind of feel yes and no. Like, I see that it is an ad, but at the same time, I feel like you can really see the love that was put into it. Like, every single moment in that game, every level, every blade of grass, every, you know, drop of water that squeezes out of the giant squishy things in that one sponge level, every single thing was done so lovingly that I really can't see it as an ad because it's just so well crafted.
The leaves and the flower petals when you spin around and they all just go whew, that's pretty incredible.
And even, you know, the way that they put that kind of like the haptics in the controller where, you know, you're walking on like metal or you're walking on bricks and you can feel it, or you're running through like little decorations all over the ground and you can feel it in the controller, like that screams more than an ad to me.
I don't know. I kind of want Justice of a Little Big Planet. I feel like Astrobot came in and like just destroyed all the ground that Little Big, or maybe possibly stood on its shoulders. But it just seems like that little space, that like little like cute little mascot, Little Big Planet, like you kind of saw him on everything. And then now it's the Astrobot. And I feel like do you feel
put
like that?
Put out your sack boys.
Yeah. Like what happened to the sack boys? Or is the sack boy, is there an Astrobot Little Big Planet? Like, is there an Astrobot Sackboy?
There is. I'm pretty sure there is in the game. You can collect him. But I think as well, for Sony and PlayStation, they've never had, I guess, the like icons that Nintendo has. And I think Xbox has the same issue, and Microsoft, where Nintendo has Kirby and that has Mario and it has all these like cute, really, really iconic characters. I think PlayStation really lacks that. So I think, you know, they've used Sackboy and Little Big Planet as, you know, a stepping stone almost in the creation of Astrobot. And I think that, I guess for me, is a really positive and nice thing because they're kind of building to this world.
What would you say is your favorite of all the references to the other games within Astrobot?
Oh my gosh. Okay. I think it has to be Solid Snake. When you collect him and he's on your planet, he hides under his little box and you like kick him and he like comes out of the box. He's like, oh my God. And goes back under the box. And I think just no matter what the character is, all those little actions and animations are so cute and so well thought out that once again, coming back to the fact that it could potentially be seen as an ad, I really can't see it being that way when there is so much effort put into it.
Well, I think like things like the Transformers movies are essentially big ads. So like, I think a game can sort of fill that space and still be a product that people buy while wholly serving itself and its machine, I guess. I don't see a problem with that.
It can be both, right?
Yeah, it can be both. And I think it's not necessarily a negative thing for a game to kind of act as an advertisement. And I think a lot of children maybe growing up and getting to play this game, for them, I think they won't quite see that. And ultimately, it is a game aimed at children, really. Like, it's a kid's game. So I don't think I personally have any issues with it. Also, the cheese level. You just get to be tiny, you get to be little, and that's all I want in my life. So no matter if it's an ad or if I'm a shill, I don't care. I want to be tiny and run through cheese holes.
Well, there it is. It's the ad.
Advertising worked.
And Courtney, other than Astrobot, you also had a couple of honorable mentions. So What also caught your eye during Game of the Year discussion time?
So for me, I tend to look towards smaller games and indie games and mobile games because I spend a lot of my time playing League of Legends, which we all know. So for me, the ones that stood out, first of all, Web Fishing. This game really snuck out. Like, there was not much discussion about it, not much advertising around it. Web Fishing is web fishing. It's a casual multiplayer fishing game, but it's based around the idea that you're in, I guess, like a web chat with your friends. So the basis of the game is you are fishing and there is kind of currency and there's the collectible aspect. But the main goal of this game is to talk with your friends while you fish as a cat or a dog or any creature you want to be. And I think that in itself is really good and a really fun way to look at gaming as a social, I guess, project or something you would work on with your friends, right? Like, I think a lot of people use Minecraft in that space, and there's not many other games that can kind of take up, I guess, like a social identity like that. But Web Fishing built itself on the basis of, I want to do something while I talk with my friends on the internet.
Yeah, I'm just looking at screenshots of this game and I'm like, yeah, that looks like something I want to try out. Looks dope.
It's so cute. It's, you know, it's like, it's just a little indie game. Like, it's nothing, you know, super special in terms of graphics or, you know, how the game plays. But the social aspect, I think, is the biggest part of it. And that's what makes it really fun.
Are the Android and Apple ecosystems, like, still separate in, like, multiplayer games on mobile? Or can you play with people on, like, other platforms?
I'm actually not sure because I've only played Web Fishing on Steam. I've never actually tried the mobile version. So I'm curious to see if you could enjoy it, like, multi-platform.
Oh, okay. I'm actually not sure that it is a mobile game. I just thought it because I thought it might be a mobile game. It might not be.
It is. It's on Steam and it's on mobile as well, but I'm not sure if it's specific to Apple or Android, but it is on mobile too.
And I know there was also another game that got an honorable mention from you, Courtney.
Yes. So I think this, I would say in my heart, and by hours of playtime, this is my other game of the year. It's Love in Deep Space, which is a mobile dating sim gacha game.
Sounds like you.
Yeah, this was incredibly on brand.
So basically, it's you are in a sci-fi world. You're the protagonist. You're the main character. And there are these four extremely hot men that are all involved in your life in some way. There's Xavier, who is like a hunter. So you're a hunter. You fight aliens. He's a hunter too. There's Zane, who's your doctor and childhood friend. There's Raphael, who is an arrogant artist. And then there's Silas, who is a vampire man.
There it is. Yeah. There. I was waiting. Yeah, for...
But to be fair, in my own defense, the one that I'm in love with is Zane, who is the doctor.
So funny. Anyway, the classic archetype. Doctor, artist, vampire.
Yeah.
Is this a lock screen? Is that what that was?
No, this is the game. So the great
I also
thing,
thought it was your lock screen.
No, the great thing about this game that I really love is that it really integrates into your day-to-day life.
Oh, there
so
it is.
You can spend quality time with these boys and you can choose to either have them working in the background while you work or while you study, or you can get them to work out with you and they'll sit there and work out with you and they get changed into their workout clothes, obviously. And I'm just going to show you guys this, what happens when you...
Wow.
Oh, my God.
So, and you can, like, move the camera as well.
I bet
of course.
Can.
Of course you can.
So,
oh, Courtney. This is an honorable mention. This is a cry for help.
But it has real gameplay. Like, you fight the beast. I play it on auto because I'm lazy.
It has real gameplay that I don't use.
But the gacha is very generous. So, you know, you can always pull for more hot cards of the boys and play out all the scenarios. And it's really fun. Any questions?
Yeah. So many.
Do they know that you're spending more time with the doctor, and do they try and like muscle in and like kind of get your attention?
No, they don't really fight because they all have their own personalities, right? So, but you also level up your relationship with them. So if you spend more time with the doctor, like, he falls in love with you more, and the others just kind of, they accept it. Accept their fate.
Oh, I want drama. I've been watching a lot of Bridgerton recently, so that's where I wanted. That's just where I am in terms of, like, you know, the romantic drama in my media.
I love
that.
This
also
for
sounds
you.
Like a crap to help.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, it's great. Yeah.
So anyway, I'm gonna just end on this.
Yeah, look at him. Wow,
he's really
Jesus.
So on that note, that's the. That's the game of the year picks from Courtney Smith, which is, oh goodness, I can't say it with a straight face, Astrobot, Web Fishing, and Love and Deep Space. And up next, we'll have the game of the year picks from Fiona Bartholomaeus.
Articles to read, podcasts to listen to, and videos to watch on sifter.com.au.
Fiona, your game of the year pick, probably a bit spooky for me, but I know you've been really, really into this all throughout 2024. Please tell me about your game of the year.
Yes, mine, it was a bit of a struggle to choose because Zelda Echoes of Wisdom came out this year, but content warning, I'm not a big horror person, but for some reason spooky
horror games. That's incredibly untrue. You're not a horror person.
Yeah.
Horror movies, TV shows, absolutely no way. But spooky co-op games, reason I love, even though it makes me want to throw myself off a bridge. But content warning, you essentially play as a vlogger. You go down to the old world, which is like a monochrome hellscape kind of, and you have to go around and film monsters and different things and then upload it to SpookTube to try and get most viewers. And like every, it's kind of like a 3-day round. So you have a viewer count that you have to meet. So it might be 15,000 or 1 million or whatever. And you have 3 days to go down to film, upload your YouTube video, and then try and get those views. And it's lots of fun and lots of screaming and lots of death.
And how does the co-op and multiplayer sort of feed into it? Is it something you can play by yourself, or is it entirely revolved around playing with other people?
You could play it by yourself, but it'd be a bit difficult because the idea is that one person has the camera and then someone might be carrying a torch and a couple of different items like a shock stick. So trying to manage that all by yourself might be a bit hard, but I play with two other friends and we take in turns. One person will be the camera person, one person will have the torch or like the shock stick, which you can use to fight off the monsters and get some good views. But there's also lots of fun items like a boom mic and a reporter mic and a film clapper and a soundboard. And there's nothing like your friend getting killed and then in the background you're playing a sad trombone noise out of your speaker. It is a lot of fun.
So if the Sifter team were to be in content warning, if we were to all not necessarily play content warning but be in content warning, A, who would we all be, what roles would we all have, and B, would we survive?
That is a good question. I feel like in real life, I would not even get down to the old world. I would be stuck in the ship the whole time. I think Gianni would be the filmer. Although in saying that, Gianni would be the filmer. Mitch would be the shock stick and be like, oh, go on, let's go fight some monsters. We'll see what happens.
Immediately dies.
Yeah. And then I think the rest of us would be like, well, we'll just follow, I guess. We'll see what happens. But there's so many things you can do, and you can... In the game as well, you can unlock stuff around your houses, like a trampoline and a podcasting booth. And like you get to learn what your viewers like. So sometimes if we have a bit of, you only have a certain amount of time to record on your camera. So sometimes if we don't hit that quota, we'll go, let's go jump on the trampoline or dive in the pool. And some viewers like it, some viewers do not care. it's funny. You can see their comments roll through.
Can you fight Mike Tyson?
You cannot.
Some of our viewers really want us to fight Mike Tyson.
But there's lots of monsters, and like I've been playing it for a while, but we still haven't actually seen all the monsters in the game, which is kind of terrifying, and I don't like that we haven't encountered them all. So I'm sure we'll get there one day, but the worst one is called Killstreamer. And Killstreamer is essentially another player, an NPC, but his job is that he films on YouTube of him just killing people. So he comes after you in the old world and like attack you and kill you. But he gets really good views if you can film him and survive.
Oh my God, that sounds like breaking TOS.
It's very traumatic. He follows you and
yeah, that'll get you banned off Kick for sure.
Not off Kick.
Oh no, not off Kick. Yeah, you probably do it on Kick.
I want to see Kyle jumping on a trampoline. That can be his job.
You can and do flips
just in general.
Yeah, generally.
I think we can all agree that Courtney's going to be hammering that trombone button the whole way around.
That is mostly me in the game, either with the clapper or the soundboard just in the background going ch-ch-ch-ch. Sometimes you can find a radio and that's equally as bad for my friends.
That sounds really fun.
Just a lot of chaos and unhinged fun.
So that's really interesting, particularly about the replayability, because I suppose a lot of these co-op and multiplayer games really do live and die off of how compelling they are to keep playing over and over again. So you mentioned the stuff to unlock for your base or your ship and also new monster types. Is that sort of the main sort of hook that keeps you coming back? Or is what is the big appeal in terms of trying and getting more views each time?
Definitely the like how it's randomized every single time. So once you get past like the first 3 days, then there's 3 or 4 different maps, and it's randomized every single time. Same with the monsters. Sometimes you'll get the one that creates a black hole. Sometimes you won't see it for many, many weeks. Yeah, that was a fun one to discover. But it's just so randomized every single time. Sometimes the game will throw items in the old world too that you can find and use, which is very nice when you get some free stuff. But it's also, I think, just really a fun game to play with your friends because you can just see how far you can go, but also sometimes the game's just like, nope, you're not leaving your ship. We're just going to spawn all the monsters right in front of you and you will not leave. So yeah, definitely the randomization aspect makes it a lot of fun.
Do you think, which one's winning the fight, Content Warning or Lethal Company? Because I feel Lethal Company was a similar sort of idea, but not quite the same. People either like one or the other.
I haven't actually played Lethal Company. I've played this Faz Forewarned, and I've started playing a new game called Pilgrim, which is equally as spooky, makes me want to throw myself off a bridge. But Content Warning is probably the winner. It gives very Vine energy, like because you can, once you film your videos and you upload them, you can actually record, like download them to keep in real life. So I actually have a folder of lots of chaotic videos, but there's a lot of like perfectly cut off screams, like one moment someone be dancing in front of a monster and then it'll cut to someone being killed and then cut to someone on a trampoline. So a lot of chaos and unhinged energy.
Oh, goodness. And thematically very different is your honourable mention, The Legend of Zelda Echoes of Wisdom. And it's just something very interesting with the Zelda franchise in terms of being actually able to play as Zelda as the main protagonist. So what was it that really, I suppose, endeared you to Echoes of Wisdom?
I really love, like, the art style, amazing. It's such the perfect way, I think, to start off a Zelda, Zelda franchise, a franchise where we actually get to play as Zelda. But she's IKEA, the embodiment of IKEA, essentially. That's the only way to describe her in this game. You can make staircases out of beds and throw rocks and tables at people. It's lots of fun. But it's gone back to the original, like, dungeon kind of layout, and I always love those dungeons in Zelda, and that's something that I've missed a little bit with Breath of the Wild and Tears of the Kingdom. So it was really cool getting to go back to that, and I'm really hoping now we get to see more of Zelda, so fingers crossed, but it's been a lot of fun to play this one.
How was the performance? Because I played the remake that they put out in the similar style, that top-down kind of 3D style, and it really struggled with the more like crowded areas.
I didn't notice anything in particular. I thought it was all quite laid out quite nicely. I think the map as well is a little bit smaller, but like there wasn't anything performance-wise that particularly popped out that made me go, oh, that's a little bit weird. But no, it's a really fun and cute game, and for once you get to save the day as Zelda and not Link, even though he does appear, and I forget he's in the game, and he just rocks up. I'm like, oh, that's right, you exist in this game. Coo, we'll come back to you one day.
Just shoo him away. This is not your time.
It's not your time. It's Zelda's time, finally.
Have there been any other games where you play as Zelda, or is this it?
I mean, in Super Smash, you can play as Zelda.
Yep.
None from memory specifically as her, I don't think.
Some of the spin-offs, the Dynasty Warriors spin-offs, Hyrule Warriors games, you can play as Zelda or some variation of. But this is certainly the first where Zelda had her own adventure where you play as the sole protagonist. Which is certainly a refreshing change. Just quickly, Fiona, we've all seen a lot of the memes, a lot of the footage of using furniture, using all sorts of items to sort of navigate through challenges and puzzles. How does it feel in terms of the actual gameplay of playing as Zelda versus Link for so many years?
I must admit, it was a little bit, not difficult, but it took a little bit to get used to the fact that she does not have a sword and I can't just run in and hit something with a sword and just fight straight away. I have to use items and things like that. Granted, there is a power set where you can turn into a version of Link, so you can have a sword, but it's only for a limited time. So it did take a little bit to get used to just more inconveniencing monsters, but with the echoes that you get along the way, you can actually get echoes of monsters and they fight for you, which I've started to enjoy because I can just get them to fight and then I can go break pots and get money and steal other items. So that is very fun now that I've gotten used to that way of playing.
It all just comes right back around to Pokemon, doesn't it?
I'm kind of shocked, though, that she doesn't have a sword, because in Hyrule Warriors, I put hundreds of hours into that game, and she has a sword in Hyrule Warriors. So I'm shocked that she doesn't use a weapon necessarily.
Yeah, they just went, princess magic, you can have magic. Sword is for Link, which is a shame because her with the sword and a bow, like as her own, would be so cool to do in this game.
Yeah, all the girlies want is a sword.
Exactly. I would love a sword.
So that is Fiona Bartholomew's Game of the Year picks. I was about to say Lethal Company, but no, that was the other one. Content warning and The Legend of Zelda Echoes of Wisdom. Up next are the Game of the Year picks from Mitch Lowe.
You're listening to Drop Rate by Sifter.
Do we drop it or do we rate it? Find out here.
Sifter.com.au.
Mitch, you've been one of many who have been fighting for democracy this year with your Game of the Year pick. Why is Helldivers 2 your Game of the Year?
Among other people fighting for real democracy this year around the world. Yes, I've been fighting for made-up democracy in the Helldivers 2, the breakout success that just appeared one day and nobody knew about it. And this is the whole parody of the fascism versus democracy. And it took over my life for about 2 weeks. And it was one of the rare occasions nowadays where I can actually get a decent amount of group of friends on a game. Now it actually managed to capture the imaginations of a lot of my mates who are now working full time and have kids and just doing their own thing. We haven't really had that since probably Destiny 2, maybe. And so jumping into that was really good. I think Helldivers managed to, I think, walk the line between a pretty decent character progression and being able to drop in, drop out like many of your battle royales. I think that's why it was so successful. And in terms of gameplay, I think a lot of people criticize the game for being really clunky, and I kind of agree. The game kind of doesn't really work in the way that is fluid, like let's say like a normal first-person shooter is, or even Fortnite third-person shooter. But I think the clunkiness is kind of what makes it a little bit agricultural, and like you're not a super soldier, you're just a person, and you're one of many, and you're disposable. And I think that really it helps sell the narrative.
Does it have a story mode? Because I actually don't know much about Helldivers 2, but I've seen a lot of clips of people playing with their friends in the, I guess, like Battle Royale mode. But does it have a story mode as well?
So it has a story mode in the sense that World of Warcraft kind of has a story mode. So we've got, I think there is one, and for the life of me, I've forgotten their name. But there's a person that's sort of riding a sort of Dungeon Master style overarching narrative of the whole thing, and like as Helldivers you can influence the planets that you visit, and as you do missions on the planet you sort of put the percentage bar up on the whole planet. So as you take planets and things happen in the story, and you kind of do collective, the whole community of the Helldivers players sort of influence the narrative in which way you can go towards massive objectives. So for example, sometimes it's destroy a particular amount of this enemy, and that number is astronomically high. You can never do it on your own, but with the whole community working together, you can burn through them. And so that is the difference between, like, it's sort of like an overarching Dungeons and Dragons style Dungeon Master narrative, which I'd never seen before in a game. I'm sure it's happened before, but that's the first time I've seen it.
That collective goal, I think, was just so refreshing. Also, the fact that there was no PvP, it was like purely a team-based co-op game. And we just don't get much of that these days, it feels like. And everyone working towards that goal. I have never seen social media blow up in the way that it did over this game. The memes, the content was just phenomenal. If you're on that side of TikTok, it was an incredible couple of months of just really fun like camaraderie and silliness as well, because it has that tongue-in-cheek Starship Troopers satirical kind of edge to it, where everybody is in on the joke, everybody is pretending that it's extremely serious. It was so fun. What a great few months.
To further that point, Kyle, I know that the TikToks and the sort of content that you're referring to, which I found really interesting, because, yeah, there's sort of this metagaming narrative taking place within the game as you're reclaiming, quote-unquote, reclaiming these planets from these various factions. But then you have so many people continuing this meta-narrative outside of the game on these social media platforms. I recall for months I was seeing in my TikTok feed people almost role-playing, doing almost their sort of video log diaries from the perspective of the front lines as one of these Helldiver soldiers, which was thoroughly, thoroughly entertaining.
Yeah, and even there were people doing like news bulletins every day, being like, this is where we're at, this is where, you know, we have pushed the enemy back on these planets and on these fronts, and this is where we need extra help. And just like, it was so fun.
We did it on walkthrough a couple of times. I think we did every time there was a Helldivers story, we kind of framed it as like a Helldivers bulletin. I think we even did that ourselves.
There's wrapped up in it for sure.
Yeah, or maybe I just did that to you guys because I edit those. Anyway, but I think, yeah, the player-driven narrative is another thing of beauty. And it's just like the rumors, the conspiracy theories over what we were up against in these worlds. It was just something wild and refreshing. And I think a level of attentiveness by the developers. They were really on top. They really had their fingers well on the pulse of where the community was and what they were thinking about the game and if they were releasing stuff, and like certain glitches were being identified or maybe misidentified as features. And it really was like a time of learning together, and that was something that I had never experienced in a game.
My big recommendation is, if you haven't played Arrowhead's previous games, Magicka, you should definitely play them, because it's like, what if it was D&D and everyone casts spells by doing the same sort of button commands that you have to do in Helldivers to fight enemies and that, and half the fun is killing your mates. It's like the DNA of Helldivers is in that game in a huge way, including, like, it was just very funny. At one point, there was like Magicka Vietnam for some reason, and you just run around in Vietnam as a wizard for some reason. So yeah, they're very cheap games, but they're so good. Just get like the same bunch of people on who play Helldivers with you and play those games. They're really, really fun.
So that is Helldivers 2, Michelot's Game of the Year. And up next is me, Chris Button.
You're listening to Drop Rate by Sifter.
Video game reviews that'll make you think.
Sifter.com.au.
It's Chris Button from Drop Rate. Chris, what's your game of the year for 2024?
Goodness me, I had such a long list to get through and it was pretty difficult to separate a few, but I ultimately went for Metaphor ReFantazio, or however you pronounce it. I actually do not know, but it is the latest JRPG from the same Atlus team responsible for the Persona franchise, of which I'm a very big fan of. And essentially, the plot is that you're trying to recover or restore to health this prince who is the heir to the throne, who's currently under a magical spell, some form of coma, and someone is trying to usurp the throne to take advantage of this situation. And essentially what happens is when this usurper tries to take the throne, it ends up being sort of this magical grand gladiatorial contest where multiple candidates for the throne have to compete for the public's favor in order to sort of claim the most popularity, and whoever's the most popular at the end of it will receive the crown. But as with a lot of Persona games, there's a lot of political intrigue, lots of twists, lots of really interesting narrative stuff, and a lot of really in-depth character building. But I think one of the big things, that there's so much that works well about Metaphor as a really cohesive video game experience that solidifies and streamlines a lot of the things from the Persona series, that cuts a lot of the fat, streamlines the mechanics without dumbing them down. And also, it's not quite as bloated a runtime as Persona 5 and Persona 5 Royal was, in which I remember playing 120 plus hours of. But it's really, really good stuff. And I've only touched the surface of it in my explanation so far.
Why are Stroll and Heisme the best boys?
Look, there's
it's a really
lot
loaded
of
question.
Which one of them does the best pull-ups, by the way? I just want to know as well. Can you see them do pull-ups?
Stroll would probably be the best due to having the longer limbs, whereas Heisme is a very cute, unassuming-looking little guy with a really deep, grisly voice.
Same.
Yeah, very, very, very surprising in terms of his appearance. So I think some of the Sifter team have just seen some visuals of who this little fella is. The visuals certainly do not match the voice, and it is glorious.
Rancor.
But in terms of why they are the best boys, they're both deeply, deeply loyal. They'll stick by your side no matter what, and they are also emblematic of one of the core themes of Metaphor, and that's one of equality and unity. So what this game does, and it doesn't do it in a gratuitous sort of way, but it does depict sort of the kingdom where this takes place. It does depict a lot of the discrimination and a lot of the prejudices that are held between the different tribes and the races that are depicted in this game. And essentially this ragtag team that you accumulate throughout your adventure, they all happen to be from one of these different tribes, and they know what it's like to be discriminated against. They know what it's like to be the downtrodden, you know, under the heel of the ruling class, and they're all about trying to make a better future and a better world for everyone around them. So this is certainly one of those games that is the right game for the right moment, given that there's a lot of stuff going on around the world where so many people are facing oppression, so many people are facing hardships, while the 1% continue to do whatever they want. So there's a lot of those themes, and it's very in your face, yet it doesn't feel heavy-handed. It feels very naturally done. And it's like, this feels like it's a mirror to the world at the moment, portrayed in this fantastical JRPG setting. And it's again, one of the many great things about this game.
I think it's really interesting, Chris, that you bring up the point of, I guess, like discrimination, because even as when you're playing as the protagonist who's from the Elder tribe, people, like, you know, you walk past people on the street and they comment, they're like, oh, is that an Elder? Ugh. Like, you know, what are they doing here? But you as the player are looking at this protagonist and you're like, that looks like a regular human being with heterochromia to me. Like, you know, the only really notable thing about the protagonist is that they have two different colored eyes. And, you know, to hear the comments from like passersby on the street, I think is really interesting. And I think almost puts the player in the shoes of, you know, people that have experienced this thing on a day-to-day basis.
And further to that, you're absolutely 100% spot on with that. Further to that, and perhaps this one is a little bit heavy-handed and a little bit on the nose, but it gets its point across effectively, is that these horrid, grotesque monsters that you fight in Metaphor Re Fantasio, they're called humans. They bear no resemblance to real-world humans. They're these monstrous beings who are very tough, very menacing, and very grotesque. But in the game and in the world that you are taking this adventure in, they're called humans, which I think, again, is part of, you know, the many allegories that that takes place in Metaphor. But I've spoken a lot about the setting and the narrative and sort of a lot of the themes that this game does really well, which sort of skims over the fact that the turn-based combat in this is fabulous. It's another distillation of what Persona 5 did really well, which again built on the previous Personas. It's so streamlined. It's so stylish. If there's one thing you're going to get from Atlus, it's style and panache and a lot of flourishes, even in the menus and UI. Navigating menus is a far more joyous and exciting experience in this game than it is in so many other menus-based games, which, again, is a known quantity when you're coming into a game made by the Atlus Persona team. And I think another one, probably the final thing that I'll mention, because I could talk about this game for quite some time and blow out this runtime even more so, is that in the Persona games, if you've played those, you know that they take place with an in-game calendar system, so that every in-game action, whether it's exploring a dungeon, meeting up with a character, honing a skill, will take a chunk of your in-game day. So it'll take an afternoon or an evening and leaves you sort of trying to plan out your day and fitting as much stuff as you can. But I think what the Persona games previously have done is, because of the way that they're structured, they lend themselves to trying to perhaps min-max and try to, metagame the game a little bit in terms of trying to do as much as you can to try and fit in all of the relationship building, all of the skill building that you can. And while there are still elements of timing with Metaphor, it's streamlined to the point where you don't have to worry about not having enough time to build your relationships with your companions and your teammates, because it's done so in a way that's more streamlined. You're able to do so while in transit from location to location in this big mechanical steampunk-esque sort of device that you transport in. So it lets you do more things in less time than in previous games from the same developer. So I think for me, someone who doesn't like to sort of look up a lot of external sources to try and maximize, you know, my enjoyment of a game, Metaphor does it better in terms of it doesn't feel like any of your time is wasted, which I really appreciate, given that it still is a sizable game of 60, 70 plus hours. So that's, you know, all of that Metaphor, right game, right time, right place. That's why it's my game of the year this year.
Are they set in the same universe, the Metaphor and Persona?
No, set in a completely different universe, which is another thing that's really interesting, is that it does away with this contemporary high school setting, which I've read some really interesting analyses that, as good as the Persona games are, if the high school setting is one that you don't vibe with or you don't connect with on any sort of level, then it doesn't have an appeal to you, whereas this is more of a high fantasy setting where you're dealing with they still look quite young, so they could be, I'm not sure how old they are actually, or sort of high teens, young adult sort of characters. But I think it does have a bit more of a broader appeal because it's not just confined to a high school setting.
Yeah, many, many hours of human existence has been wasted trying to figure out how old an anime character is. Yeah, so
I'm not touching that topic with a 10-foot pole.
All right, Chris, any honorable mentions just briefly before we jump in to see what Carl has been enjoying this year?
Yeah, very briefly. One that I've only recently just published a review of at the time of recording is Indiana Jones and the Great Circle. In fact, this very, very nearly got my Game of the Year pick, but I think I may sort of judge it a bit harsher in terms of my Game of the Year pick purely due to recency bias. I think had I reviewed it a couple of months ago and still felt the same way that I do about it now, it might have just got my pick, but that's why it's just an honorable mention at this stage. But it's such a wonderful translation of the cinematic quality of the Indiana Jones franchise to the video game setting. And I'm a big fan of Machine Games, the developers who also did the recent Wolfenstein reboots. Their gameplay is brilliant. It's all about punching fascists and Nazis, which again, like sort of like metaphor, right game, right time, right place. This Indiana Jones game is another one as such, and it does a lot of things. It's a first person action, sort of more exploration based, really satisfying mysteries. These densely layered levels, which feel like living, breathing dioramas to explore and find secrets and find different ways of doing things. And the way that it does feel like sort of the spirit of the movies in a video game, with the gameplay of Wolfenstein combined with Hitman combined with immersive sims, it's fantastic. It's brilliant. It completely blindsided me. I should have known because I love Machine Games work, but I was not expecting it to be this good.
I thought old mate's voice acting is not bad. Troy Baker. He does a pretty good job.
Yeah, I was really surprised. There are some moments where it does sound a little bit like he's doing a Harrison Ford impression, but a lot of the time he just sinks effortlessly into the role. So I've been really impressed by that.
Well, there you go. Late recommendation for Chris there. Let's find out next what Kyle enjoyed this year in 2024.
Sit down for a chat with your pals in video games.
You're listening to Sifter.
Now, Kyle, time for your game of the year, which is a bit of an indie darling of 2024. Tell us why Animal Well is your game of the year.
Yeah, definitely a darling. It seems that everybody who touches it absolutely loves it. I'm yet to hear a bad word, and that is for good reason, in my opinion. It's basically everything that you want from an indie game. It's made by one person, so shout out to Billy Basso is the developer, and he did everything, you know, music, design, everything from the ground up was Billy Basso. And that single vision comes through just so strong, and you can feel the passion in it. And I should also say published by Big Mode, a new publisher. This is their first game, but it's basically everything I like about a bunch of my favorite games recently picked out and chucked into one thing. So it's got like the exploration and the atmosphere of Hollow Knight, but the problem solving aspects of Legend of Zelda, and the lack of hand holding of Elden Ring, and it's all wrapped into this incredibly incredibly tight, multi-layered package. Before I get into that, though, I should say what it is. Basically, you wake up and you're a little guy. Lots of little guys in this year's episode. You burst from a flower. A flower opens. You jump out and you're just this little guy, this little kind of Kirby-looking guy. And all you can do is jump and that's it. And you're off. Doesn't tell you anything. You're just off. And you essentially just explore and solve puzzles and meet lots of little animal friends and open up the map. It's got this really unique pixel retro style that seems really simple when you're just getting from one place to the other and traversing the map. But when you stop for a moment in some of the bigger areas and you just soak everything in, you realize how much is actually happening and how much detail and how precise it all is. Combine that with this really minimalist music design that is quite conservative. So it's really impactful when it just goes for it. And all of that combined makes this just super atmospheric experience that it just stands out against a sea of identical looking AAA titles. And the other thing is, unlike a lot of those AAA titles that are just obsessed with like waypoints and quest checklists, and like I said, it just drops you in and leaves you completely to figure it out on your own. And it's really nice to feel like a developer trusts the player to know how to play a video game and to find their way and to figure it out instead of being beaten over the head with instructions and exposition. And I know that those things are in place for people. You know, you never know when a game is someone's first game, but I really think that anybody with, you know, really limited understanding of gaming could jump into Animal Well and have a really good time with it. It's just incredible.
Does the narrative like start to develop after a while, or is it just purely exploration and puzzle solving?
I'm not sure if there is a narrative. If it is, it's extremely obscure. It's abstract, I should say. It's not like a lot of indie games where it's, you know, a nice story where you can wrap it up at the end, and you know you're not going to get to the end and be like, oh, this was a nice Celeste style where, you know, they overcame their self-doubt and stuff like that. It's really not that. It's much more about the experience of discovering it yourself. And one of the cool things it does is it's similar to Breath of the Wild and Tears of the Kingdom, where you think that you've stumbled across the solution to a problem, when in reality the devs planned it all along, but it makes you feel really, really good. It's just great. But it's and I don't want this to turn anybody off, because it is accessible, but the levels of this game are unimaginable. So if you can bear with me for a moment, on the surface there is about a 6-hour main game, really, really easily digestible. You just jump in, puzzles, exploration, platforming, you figure it out, you get a credit screen rolls down. It's not really any combat or anything, and that's just it. That takes about 6 hours. Then there's about another 5 hours where you can do all of it, make sure you unlock the whole map, get all of the collectibles and stuff like that. And then there's a third layer where things start to get a little bit weird. It's without a guide, I just don't know how people were figuring this out. I'm talking like putting in work outside of the game, writing handwritten kind of diagrams to figure out the puzzles. There's one puzzle in particular that requires 50 other people playing the game to come together, because each person only gets one individual kind of piece of the puzzle. So you have to collaborate with other players in the real world. And then there is a fourth level, which is like the developer Basso, he intended it to take a decade for people to figure out how to finish this layer of it. Because of the internet and everything, it has taken people, the community, a bit, you know, less time than that. They've kind of figured it out. But it's more about like deciphering codes and losing your mind and looking at like pixel perfect little clues in the game. It's insane. But the fact that it's even in there is really cool. And again, one dude put all of this in there. So it's a wild rabbit hole to go down. Even if you're not going to play the game, I suggest looking into it. Just find a YouTube video of someone breaking it down, because it's really fascinating. And like I said, don't let that deter you, because like myself, I don't have a lot of time for gaming. I only really got into the first two levels. I don't have time to be deciphering codes like some kind of, you know, World War One spy or something. And the first layer on its own is well worth the price of admission. It's a relatively cheap game, and the second layer is fun for like kind of casual completionists. It's it was an absolute treat to experience. I loved it.
Must have been really good for you to pick an indie game that you liked, Kyle.
Thanks. Yeah, it was. It was good to not have to hate on something. That's for sure. That's what happens when people make good games.
Well, I won't tease too many other details out, because I know a lot of the joy of Animal Well is reliant on its mystery and sense of exploration and wonder. But I do also know, Kyle, there are a couple of honourable mentions this year for you. Would you like to share what's topped your list?
That's right. And it's actually a bit of a hot topic, because both of them are DLCs, which I'm not sure if that counts. I know that is a conversation that is being had at the moment. And fittingly, one of them is Shadow of the Erdtree, Elden Ring's DLC. I'm not sure anything more needs to be said about this than hasn't already been said. Everybody knows Elden Ring is potentially the best game of all time, and its DLC was just more
not
of
for
that.
You, apparently.
I'm just not sure that a DLC deserves that top spot, but Shadow of the Erdtree was a phenomenal play. I absolutely loved diving back into that world. And my other honourable mention is DayZ Frostline, which is the latest update from that game, which has been out for just eternity at this time. I think officially it came out in 2018, but it was in early access for a long time before that. And if you know anything about DayZ, it's incredibly punishing. You get dropped in with nothing and just have to figure it out. And this Frostline is the same base game, except also it's incredibly cold and snowing, and the wildlife is even harsher. And so it's just cranked that difficulty up. And I'm having a lot of fun figuring out how to survive longer than a half an hour before I freeze or starve to death. It's really fun. And putting this list together has also made me realize what I love about certain games, and that is not having my handheld, which runs through all three of those games.
You're a strong, independent man.
I think that must be it. Thanks, Chris.
Well, those are the Game of the Year picks from Kyle Pauletto, Elden Ring Shadow of the Erdtree, DayZ Frostline, and Animal Well. Coming up next is the boss man himself, Gianni Di Giovanni. Stay tuned for that.
Join the Sifter community on Discord at sifter.com.au/Discord.
Now, Gianni, your Game of the Year pick is one that caught my attention as well. In fact, we spoke about this on a Drop Rate episode earlier in the year. Tell us what makes Unicorn Overlord your Game of the Year.
I always like to pick games that stick with me beyond just the playtime of it, that I'm thinking about it outside of having hands on the device, outside of playing through it directly, that I'm, when I'm doing other things, I'm like, oh, I just need to get back and think into it. So for me, Unicorn Overlord, which is like a tactical strategy game, fantasy style, has a bit of the same sort of elements as sort of the Fire Emblem games in some capacities, but fights completely different. Has a lot of sort of programmatic battles in it as well, so you can set up squads with really cool like rules and techniques and everything, and build like the best battle squad as you go. Like a lot of that is really, really cool, and it just was a game that just stuck in my mind for such a long time, because there were so many different elements to sort of work through, building up new team comps and then you get into the extra stuff. The story is pretty cool as well. It's like you're an exiled prince. You've got to kind of come back to your homeland and fight for freedom across the variety of different communities that are there, finding out why you know, your kingdom fell to this evil person, and then goes on after that point as well. It's got it's a shame that Courtney and Adam haven't been able to stick around for the end of this one, but it's got plenty of anime waifus in it, and it's a relatively horny game. All the Vanillaware stuff is pretty full on. This is no exception. It means that the previous games were. Yeah, Courtney is here. Hello, Courtney.
That was insane. Courtney just
back.
Yeah, as soon as you said that it was horny. That is crazy.
You've summoned Courtney with the power of waifus.
Did you say anime waifu?
It's your bat signal up in the air. There you go. It's like there's, it's just got a lot to it. And I think in terms of a game that is really fun and everyone who will play through it, it will play through it in a slightly different way. It has a really cool system built into it. What I really like is that the art style in this and all of the Vanillaware games are incredible, and this sort of like hand-drawn art style, which is really kind of stunning to look at. It's just one of these games that I just kept thinking about for ages. It's one of those ones I just recommend to people to play. You can make it as hard or as easy as you want it to be. Whoever plays this game will kind of get something out of it. And it's got like all that sort of like fantasy nonsense that's fun from like an RPG. So I really, really loved it. It was one of those things that was not a huge surprise for me, because I like other Vanillaware games that have come out in the past, like 13 Sentinels. But it is, it was to a big level. As soon as it was announced, I think we talked about it maybe last year on the Game of the Year. I was like, yep, that's it. I'm going to play this game 100%. Day one, grab that one. So, yeah, Unicorn Overlord is my pick for 2024.
And I know you've got a couple of honorable mentions as well, Gianni, a couple of which have been discussed already. So would you like to talk us through them?
Yeah, some really good ones this year. I loved Echoes of Wisdom, Zelda. It was, because it's a spin-off of the Link's Awakening remake in terms of engine. I just love that game and I love that style. It was really fun. Really cool to be able to play as Zelda and have her be her own character for once, which is really good, rather than just being, something you have to go and save, an item to save, which is most of what Zelda's characterization had been in the past. So I really, really love that. And the way that they're kind of taking Zelda in this direction now, where it's just like kooky sandbox sort of stuff, that's really good. I love that they're doing that. The fact that you can break the game, and that's the whole point, I think that's really cool. Breath of the Wild has set something off in the creative minds of the people who make Zelda games, and that's really, really good. I love Astro Bot as well. I just think in terms of like having a fun, enjoyable platformer that's just really well made and looks stunning, and it's just style, which means that it's going to hold up for ages. Like, this game will look good in 10, 15 years because it's just so cool the way that they've actually put it together. So it's one of those ones that I think is fantastic. And I'll give an honorable mention to Helldivers as well, because we had a lot of fun playing that one as we were diving in, and some of the soundtrack in that is incredible. So they're my three other picks for games of the year for my honorable mentions for 2024.
And you also, so you forgot to mention Shadow of the Erdtree.
I've also been playing Animal Crossing Pocket Camp on Complete on my mobile phone, and that's quite a good game as well. It's got a bit of that gacha stuff that I know you like, Courtney. So,
yeah, that does sound more your speed, actually.
Oh, thank you very much, Gianni. That's Unicorn Overlord, Helldivers 2, Legend of Zelda, Echoes of Wisdom, Astro Bot, and sure, let's throw a mention for Animal Crossing Pocket Camp Complete Edition as well. Stay tuned as we wrap up our Game of the Year discussion.
You're listening to Drop Rate by Sifter. Visit us on sifter.com.au.
Thank you so much for joining the Sifter crew for our 2024 Game of the Year discussion. And thank you for all your support and listening to our episodes and interacting with us online throughout the year. To save us all doing individual intros, you can find all of our social media handles and all of that online and in the show notes if you'd like to follow us and read more of our work. But also just a quick little special shout out, Courtney, would you like to share the recent podcast network that you've launched?
I would love to. Thank you so much for giving me the space to do this. But I have recently launched Sakura Society, which is a podcast network created by myself and Brendan White. We are Australia's self-proclaimed biggest anime expert. So, of course, it made sense that we would launch a podcast network that's all about anime. We currently have two podcasts on there, More Than Headlines and More Than Hentai, both of which are great to listen to despite the name. Please give us a follow at Sakura Society.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Courtney. And thank you, everyone, once again for listening to Drop Right and Sifter. And a quick thank you to Apple and Audio Technica for their support of the Sifter Network throughout the year. And we hope to hear more from you in 2025.
Hey there, Gianni here on the latest episode of Lightmap Sifter's interview podcast. I speak to the designers of Valve's Steam Deck and find out how the handheld has changed the way gamers play.
We did run some numbers a while back about like how like the time split between like your PC and your Steam Deck. And we saw something like 40% of people who got a Steam Deck ended up spending more time on their Steam Deck playing PC games than on their desktop, which we thought was kind of interesting. So it's like the reason we wanted to make a Steam Deck was to make customers happy, give them more ways to play their PC games in the way that they want to. And we found that it's been sticky. Like people have found that the Steam Deck has been giving them more reasons, more ways to play games in different places. And that's a success in our minds.
You can get every episode of Lightmap for free on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, on YouTube, or head to our website, sifter.com.au.